Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Cary Nelson. He's a Jubilee Professor of Arts and Sciences and a Professor of English at the University of Illinois. From 2006 to 2012, he was the President of the American Association of University Professors. His recent book, which draws on his experiences in that position, is No University is an Island. Cary, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
Let's start with an overview. Could you give me a brief overview of how the changes in the economics of higher education have shifted the way that college and university faculty are viewed and treated as a labor force?
Well, there's no question what the most dramatic change is, and that's the huge increase in the reliance on part-time teachers rather than full-time faculty. The statistic I like to quote is that in 1975, two-thirds of American faculty were either tenured or eligible for tenure. Exactly 30 years later, it was one-third, and it's down below 30% now. It may be as low as 20%. So that means lots of things. It means that faculty members are much more vulnerable than they were before. If a legislator or a local minister doesn't like the things they're saying in the classroom, an administration can decide, well, this person's a troublemaker, he or she is inconvenient, let's just get rid of them. In fact, they don't actually get rid of them. They just don't give them a new contract next year. They just disappear. It's kind of a non-event. And that means that, you know, the American faculty as a whole, the professoriate, is much less secure. Obviously, these people are earning a tiny fraction of what a typical professional income would be. There was a terrible story on PBS just a couple of weeks ago that they found a part-time faculty member teaching at several different schools, which often happens, who was managing to earn $50,000 a year. And I've never met a part-time faculty member earning half that, let alone. I mean, it's a very deceptive story. They often live hand-to-mouth. They typically have no health care coverage. I've met people who have a problem pregnancy, get hit by a bus, a car, whatever, and, you know, like other Americans without health care, they're in a lot of trouble. So that's been a huge change in higher education.
And I was curious to know what you think is driving that. I mean, the economics is what we started with. Are there things other than economic pressures that are driving that shift toward, well, your word for them is contingent faculty, yeah, the contingency problem?
We keep struggling for the right word that they won't find insulting, and that's kind of what we're at now. But now there's a backlash to that word, so who heaven knows what it will be by next week.
What's driving it beyond the economics? Anything else?
Well, I think it is primarily driven by a desire to dramatically not just save money but shift money to other things. Certainly, upper-level administrative salaries, in addition to the number of administrative posts in higher education, have really increased dramatically over the last two generations. For me, the notion of a kind of million-dollar college president, let alone a $5 million college coach, doesn't really warm my heart. I tend to think of higher education as being more of a community, and that it shouldn't be structured economically, you know, like a Ford plant where the CEO earns all this money and the gals on the shop floor can barely make, you know, put food on the table. But higher education is becoming like that. It's clearly becoming like that because it's imitating a lot of else in the United States in the way corporations are run. I just think, you know, universities should hew to a higher ethical standard, not only for themselves but for the communities that they live in. And it should be more a model of everyone on campus putting their shoulder to the wheel rather than being hierarchically structured with people earning a tremendous amount of money and others not making enough to live on. I mean, also, it's been tempting for administrators to adopt that kind of model because it also changes the power relations on campus. These contingent faculty don't have much say in the curriculum. It does give those administrators control, power. You know, the faculty is now much more disenfranchised, and I think that's been appealing to those administrators who feel they know best and they ought to make the decisions. Whereas I see a university as a place that should make decisions collaboratively. But you want to take advantage of people's strengths, their knowledge, their expertise, And this new system is diminishing that kind of capacity.
And you've spoken a lot about the effects of this on the contingent labor force, on these part-time faculty members. A lot of our listeners to this program are parents of college-age children or soon-to-be college-age children. Why should these changes concern them specifically in terms of what their kids are going to be experiencing in college?
Yeah, that's obviously a really important question. First of all, contingent faculty, which means faculty without job security, their contracts typically no more than a year. Often the contracts are semester by semester. They come and go. So you take a course from one of those faculty members. You want a recommendation 2 years later. Where is he? Where is she? They're nowhere to be found. They have no office on campus. They have no campus email address. They have no phone number on campus. You could hire a private detective, but, I think that's still expensive now that Humphrey Bogart isn't doing the job cheaply anymore. So that's one difference, which is, the simple reliability of the access that that students have toward those faculty members. The next problem is most contingent faculty can't make a living at all unless they teach at several different schools. So they often have no office hours. There's no regular access to them. They're basically, in a sense, they're penalized for trying to really give students the kind of mentoring that they need. They're not around. If they're around, then they're not earning the other dollar that they need to earn. I mean, I've been looking at this workforce problem for almost 30 years, and I've met plenty of people whose office, college professors, whose office is the trunk of their car in the parking lot. The student comes out, that's where papers are kept. They sit in the car to talk. I'm sorry, where I am in Illinois, the winters are a little cold. It's not that, a car is not that convenient a place. Or they meet in the cafeteria, which, if you've ever been in a college cafeteria, it's not quite as noisy as a football game, but it's close enough. It's not a place to talk through a student's needs and problems. So students are getting the shaft on this kind of arrangement. The worst part of it is, I think, is that the students who need mentoring most, the children of the poor, the children of first-generation college attendees, they're the ones who need it most, and they're the students most likely to get this kind of instruction. No matter how much the instructors love them, they can't necessarily give them the attention the students need.
I want to come back and ask you a question exactly about that. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Carrie Nelson, an English professor at the University of Illinois and a past president of the American Association of University Professors. Yeah, to pick up on that note, as I read your book, it struck me that one of the effects of this contingency problem that you're talking about is that it would exacerbate the inequalities that are already present in the higher education system, inequalities among different kinds of institutions, and, as you just said, among the students that populate them. So tell me more about that.
Look back historically. After the Second World War, there was a huge expansion of the higher education system in the United States, and it was a wonderful democratizing event because it meant that so many more students had access to higher education. In the intervening decades, they need higher education even more. It's not a great way to earn a living not just to come out with a high school degree, which, about 18% of the high schools in the United States are actually still terrific. But there's a lot of them that aren't, and they don't really prepare you to work creatively on a job. They don't give you the level of skills that you need. So that huge expansion of the higher education system is in part designed to do a kind of social engineering, to create greater equality of opportunity. But over the last 20 years, that system has become more and more hierarchized. The way it looks now is one kind of education for wealthy people and another kind of education for the poor and the middle class. That's not what we were trying to design 60 years ago. It really isn't. It wasn't the purpose of expanding the higher education system. So the social benefits of vastly expanded higher education have diminished because we've allowed it to decay in this way. That's a huge price. It's not good for democracy. It's not good for citizen participation in democratic life. all of those things would be enhanced by a more fair and open system.
My guest is Cary Nelson. He's a Jubilee Professor of Arts and Sciences and an English professor at the University of Illinois. He's also a past president of the American Association of University Professors and the author of No University is an Island. Well, I want to think about the kinds of changes you've been talking about, but beyond the question of faculty as a labor force. And one of the things that you will hear on campuses from administrators looking at the future, and I've heard it here at Syracuse University, is that the traditional model of higher education and the assumptions that it makes about the cost of education relative to affordability and debt is just – it's simply not sustainable going forward. So do you think that's going to require some fundamental changes in how we think about the mission of higher education and how it's structured?
I think that the model needs adjustment. But that if we're really going to throw the mission out the window, then in fact we've let the financial pressures ruin the system. I mean, for example, I think that, you know, unlike some other friends of mine, I think there's a space for a certain amount of online learning, even with a standard bricks and mortar face-to-face undergraduate education. I think you could save money by doing 20 or 25% of it with online courses. After that, you start really losing the value-added quality that you get in being with actual human beings in a space in which you can recognize one another. I mean, I've done some online work. You get people from all over the world. That's very exciting. But you also don't get the same results when you don't know your students personally and get to work with them personally and in small groups, which to me is just unbelievably rewarding. I mean, some of my best hours of the week are spent with a class that gets passionately involved in talking about something. And that only happens because there's a limited number of us in the room. We develop a relationship with one another over the course of a semester, and it can be very, very intense. And you're not going to do that with an online thing. We happen to have, I think, because I've been around the world a fair amount, the best educational system in the world. I mean, is there a reason why we want to get rid of it? I mean, is that going to help us out? People from all over the world come to study here, and it's in part because they get challenged by the face-to-face interactions that happen in American classrooms. So many other countries, students sit quietly and don't open their mouths, you know? Here they give you a hard time, and that's what makes teaching exciting. And that just cannot happen without a high degree of face-to-face contact. So I'm a believer in that. I'm also a believer that there's a place for large lecture courses, which are also economical, because part of what you get from that is hearing a very well-trained faculty member lay out arguments in an extremely well-organized and persuasive way. So I think, you know, there's space for large classes, small classes, some online, most face-to-face, and that we can save some money by doing that. We can also save some money by not overpaying administrators. I'm sorry to say nothing of the football coach. I mean, that is that's money that can be spent more rationally. And I think if we make budgeting more of a collaborative process on campus, we'll also be less likely to waste money.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with Cary Nelson, a professor at the University of Illinois and the past president of the American Association of University Professors. Well, we've been talking a lot, and particularly earlier in the conversation, about faculty outside of the tenure system, again, the contingent faculty, you call them. But a lot of the discussion about higher education and faculty focuses on the institution of tenure, and it has its detractors. So why does tenure get attacked?
I think more than anything else these days, it gets attacked out of a kind of populist resentment. Why do you got something that I don't have? Are you telling me you have a pension? Are you telling me you have health care? I don't have those things. Why should you have them? I mean, I think we have lost the sense that college teaching is a profession like other highly educated professions, and that it requires that kind of investment to make it work. And there has also been, for more than a generation, a lot of attacks on college faculty, largely from the right wing. I don't happen to think they're accurate. I find very little dead wood on college faculties. There used to be a fair amount of it, in part because if you go back to the 1960s, there were many more jobs than there were applicants for them. And so actually department heads back then used to fly around the country trying to hire faculty members. The people doing the flying these days are the candidates, not the department heads. And there are many, many more candidates, I mean, for positions. I've done job searches at the University of Illinois where we have over 1,000 applicants for one job. Any school in the country can hire absolutely superb faculty members. And if you do that hiring carefully, you want to keep them around after tenure. Your tenure is a celebration. It just confirms the judgment that you made. Then the way tenure works, after 6 years, you get to make a decision about whether they get tenure or not. And I've personally been involved in firing quite a few people at that point. I do not cry any crocodile tears if they have not met the grade. It's sayonara, and I hire someone better. So the tenure system gives you 2 points when you get to make a very serious, considered decision, once when you hire and once when you grant tenure or don't grant tenure. And I think if you do both those things well, the system works well. And then what it does is give people the courage to disagree, the courage to take controversial stands, the courage to challenge their students. I challenge my students, right? And they're more interesting when I get them upset sometimes. When I get something going in the classroom, that's a lot more fun to me. But it's very hard for contingent faculty to do that. I mean, especially the last decade, I've had many conversations with contingent faculty where they admit to me that they're designing the syllabus for their course, and they decide not to put a book or essay on the syllabus because they think it might be controversial and some of the students might get upset at reading it. That's exactly the opposite of what American colleges are supposed to be about. You're supposed to pick things that challenge your students, not hide and avoid them because you're afraid of being punished. I mean, that's a terrible result of this new system where people have to pull back from challenging their students. That's not how you get people to think.
Let me ask you the other side of the coin, though. One of the criticisms I think that gets made of the tenure system is that tenured faculty, so the argument goes, aren't answerable to anyone. They're too independent. So who should a tenured faculty member answer to?
I've never been particularly good at answering to anybody since I was very young. When I was first denied tenure, the official charge was insubordination. I always felt that the charge was accurate, but that the punishment wasn't fair. So I'm not sure that I'm the best person to claim what answerable should or shouldn't be. But I think, remember that a department is a collaborative enterprise. You get to discuss what you might want to teach, what you have to teach, what you can teach with your colleagues. The students, for the most part, get to vote with their feet. I've known many cases around the country where less successful teachers find that their classrooms are empty because the students are not taking their courses. A lot of courses are electives. Students aren't forced to take them. So it's a tenured faculty member still exists in a social relationship with his or her colleagues and with their students. And it's not like you just are, you're just an unchecked missile. It's not, it's a community and you still have to live within it. So they're answerable in lots of complex ways. But they shouldn't be answerable in terms of don't say that. Mm. We don't like to hear that from you. That's controversial. What you need at minimum is enough of a percentage of tenured faculty on campus to sustain everyone else's academic freedom. Years ago in my department, we taught the first gay studies course, gay literature in English. And the college president saw it in the catalog and called up the department head and said, "What is this taking place at the University of Illinois for? I want an explanation of why such a thing is being taught here." It wasn't Scalia who eventually went to the Supreme Court. We didn't have him as our college president. And the department head said, that's a growing field. Study of gay literature is happening more and more, and this department has to stay up to date. We're glad to have a young person willing to teach that. And, you know, the university president, who didn't know too much, as they often don't, grumbled and complained, but he had to back off because academic freedom guaranteed that right. I wouldn't want to see the same thing happening at a little community college where no one has tenure and no one has academic freedom. And then, you know, the person isn't protected any longer. Now, that person teaching that course didn't have tenure. She was, in fact, just a graduate student. But tenured faculty members like me and others said, you know, don't mess with her. And that was sufficient.
Let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I think trying to negotiate between what are still my local responsibilities and an increasing national role and, you know, trying to remember that I actually do live in Champaign-Urbana despite being on the road a lot and kind of being on email and phone contact all over the country. So it's a strange world to be, you know, still located in a place but sort of often elsewhere.
Second, what's your worst trait?
What I'm accused of as my worst trait, which is entirely inaccurate, is arrogance. And, you know, it's just not true. I can assert that without any doubt whatsoever.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
I'm still a modern poetry scholar, and I still produce modern poetry scholarship. And I think there's been a surprise that's happened over and over again when I've discovered something about American literature that I didn't know before, and I discovered that, in fact, I was ignorant. And the last time that happened was last year, when I discovered that I had been teaching Native American poetry inaccurately for 40 years. So had everyone else in the country, because we all thought that Native American poetry as real poetry, as opposed to, you know, songs and chants and stuff, began in the 1960s. In fact, work by scholars, including a friend of mine in my own department, has revealed that there were Native American newspapers back to the 19th century printing very elaborate poems that none of the rest of us ever read. So we were teaching a lie. We didn't know it. We wouldn't have wanted to. But that has happened to me over and over again. And so the surprise is that you don't know as much as you thought, that there's a lot more to learn, and that academia is full of these wonderful surprises when your sense of the past changes.
That was Cary Nelson. His book is No University is an Island. Cary, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. A lot of fun.
I'm Grant Reher. Join me again next week on WRVO Public Media for more conversation in the public interest.
Support comes from the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University, dedicated to the study and practice of citizenship, leadership, and public governance. Information at campbellinstitute.org.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher. Associate producers include Bethany Wallowender, Kelly Coleman, John Fornoff, Stephanie Lee, Penish Pullickle, and Sophia Celeste Tate, and recording engineer Tom Fazio. For more information on the Campbell Conversations, visit WRVO.org.